You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth, thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. All across the United States of America, from side to wide side in Canada, all across the UK, Australia, all of Europe and Asia, and even into Africa, welcome to the show. K-Files Easing goes out tonight, right after the show. Just a quick reminder, because if you haven't subscribed, I asked this question once before, I'll ask it again. What's the genius in that? If you're not subscribed, you're not getting the inside information on the show and inside information about people related to the show and its genre. So go over and subscribe. It's absolutely free. Just go to kevinsmithshow.com and click where it says K-Files E-Zine. An update, my wife is home from the hospital. Thank you for all of you who have sent your messages of concern for her. I appreciate it very, very much, as does she. We do appreciate it. Let me remind you about our members area special. If you subscribe to our members area, the members area is where you'll find all of the archived shows. You'll find, we've got the K-Pods, that's the archived shows. You'll find a library of free ebooks to download. You'll find the Video Galaxy. You'll find the forums. You'll find the chat room. And I'll be in the chat room tomorrow night. So you want to be sure and join now and then jump over in the chat room with us tomorrow night. But if you join on a quarterly basis, this is what we're going to send you as a thank you gift. It is the DVD, Our Star Wars Reel. It is an interview by Ed Grimsley, interviewing Joanne Richards as she talks about her husband's role in a secret space program. If you join and sign up for annual membership, we're going to send you both that DVD and Ed Grimsley's other DVD called UFO Wars, and this is looking at UFOs through night vision goggles. You can't see them with your naked eye, but when you use the night vision goggles, you can see fleets of them, and so that's his DVD, UFO Wars. We'll send both of those to you free of charge as a thank you gift whenever you subscribe on an annual basis. So if you've been thinking, okay, one of these days I'm going to subscribe, well, may I suggest now would be a good time, because that offer ends at midnight on Sunday night, okay? We've held it open for 2 weeks, and you've got the opportunity to do it. We've got in this week's K-Files E-Zine, there are some cool Mother's Day specials. Now, if you haven't gotten your mother something for Mother's Day, shame on you. There's still time for you to get it, and we've got some cool Mother's Day specials that are being offered by a couple of our sponsors, and you want to take advantage of those, save some money, and get your mom something nice for Mother's Day. My guest this evening is Dr. Joseph Farrell. Dr. Farrell has been with us on a number of occasions before. And it's always interesting, always challenging, And I know we're going to have an in-depth, interesting, and challenging 2 hours. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and to my guest, Dr. Joseph Farrell. We're talking about the Nazis after World War II and what actually happened with them, what actually took place, and it's pretty interesting. And I would have to say ominous stuff. But during the break, we were just talking about this telephone problem. And I have to tell you folks what I told him. Right up till about 15 minutes before the show started, I was using this equipment and talking to two different friends and then my sister, and I haven't changed anything. I didn't touch a thing. It was working perfectly, and we try to bring him on, and it won't work. A little bit fishy. Anyway,
just a little bit.
But we've done it the old-fashioned way, and that is... I put him on the speakerphone and hung a mic right over the speaker, so he's with us. All right, Dr. Farrell, you were talking about South America and the stories about the Nazis surviving into South America when we had to go away for break. So let's pick up there. We've all heard those, I'll call them rumors, because that's the way we've heard them. We've heard them as rumors that there were Nazi encampments, colonies, if you will, in South America. So what about that? What's the deal with that?
Well, as I mentioned before the break, one of the stories that you persistently get, especially in Argentina, if you go to a certain region of Argentina called Rio Negro Province and ask the locals there, they are adamant that Hitler himself survived the war and that Bormann was in this area. And I got to digging in this area and actually was contacted as I was writing this book by a group, we'll just say a group of veterans of a fallen nation's military services during the war.
You know? Mm-hmm.
And they provided me with all sorts of pictures and information, which was, you know, I included these in the book. But there is a town in Rio Negro province called San Carlos de Bariloche, and if you take a compass and draw a 100-mile radius circle around that town, within that area, I won't say where, there is a large encampment. It's called Estancia, and it's about an area of about 10,000 square miles. So we're talking about an area the size of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And this is an area that the Nazis bought before and during the war and built all sorts of things, including, now get this, a large hotel. I have a picture of this in the book. It's very distinctive German architecture. It was a hotel, but it was originally built as a plastic surgery clinic. Okay, so that kind of gives you the story right there. But in this area, also, after the war, I discovered that there was one of these post-war Nazi research projects. So, yeah, this is a very large, well-financed, well-organized, well-greased machine that you have down there.
Well, and it's still in existence today?
Oh, yes, that region is still very heavily Germanized. You can see some of the contemporary pictures of the architecture there. And as far as I know, the local German veterans or their families, their descendants, still meet in this hotel to this day on April 20th every year and celebrate Adolf Hitler's birthday. So, yes, this is definitely still there.
All right. Now, what was the date of Adolf Hitler's alleged suicide?
That would have been April 30th, 1945. That's the date that he had that very peculiar flight into and out of Berlin by Hanna Reich and General Luftwaffe General Robert von Greim. So excuse me. It was April 30th. I suspect, and I present information in the book, however, that Bormann and Miller did one of their substitutions of a double for Hitler in those last weeks of the war in the bunker, and actually got Hitler himself out of Germany prior to that time. And there is a little bit of a conflict that I mentioned in the book. There's two different versions as to whether or not Eva Braun herself made it out with Hitler. I don't think she did.
Well, that would be in keeping with his character for sure.
Oh, yes, definitely, and it certainly would be in keeping with Martin Bormann's character. I mean, it's very clear when you read the book that Bormann is really the mastermind toward the end of the war, driving all these plans for post-war Nazi survival and making sure everybody's got their obfuscated stories down to a T to mislead Allied investigators. And Bormann being Bormann, I mean, here we're dealing with kind of a Dick Cheney without the warmth and charm, okay? So Bormann being Bormann, one less body to take care of and get out of Germany, you know, is fine by him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right, so you're of the opinion that Eva Braun actually did die, as reported, and Hitler did not. Am I correct?
Yeah, well, I present a scenario in the book that was actually something that was recounted by a former Spanish spy for the Nazis just before his death and recounted to the leader of this veterans group. But he maintained that he was in the bunker at the end of the war and he saw all these operations with doubles taking place, and that Bormann had actually drugged both Hitler and Eva Braun to get them out of the bunker. But Eva Braun died of, quote-unquote, an accidental overdose, okay? So, you know, that's typical Bormann right there. But it's interesting to me that this story has one unusual bit of very solid corroboration, and that is that this man alone mentioned that Grand Admiral Dönitz was in Berlin on a particular date that no one remembered until the head of this veterans group contacted Dönitz's aide, who was still alive at the time, and asked him if he could find out if Grand Admiral Dönitz was indeed in Berlin, because there was no other record of it other than this story. And this man confirmed that, yes, according to his records, Grand Admiral Dönitz had gone down to Berlin on a very quick and unusual trip, and there was no record in the files as to what the trip was for. So, yeah, it's a very, very murky and ominous story, as you say.
Okay, now, a lot of our listeners will be familiar with the story, the rumor or theory about a fleet of, or a flotilla of U-boats at the end of the war.
Yes.
Heading south toward Antarctica,
right.
And the rumor being that the Fuhrer perhaps was on that, and they were headed to Neuschwabenland.
Right.
What's the deal with that? What kind of veracity does that story have?
Well, let me put it to you this way, Kevin. I've heard that story. I reproduced the story in my first book on all of this, Reich of the Black Sun. But my opinion is, if the Germans had any sort of base in Antarctica, logistically, it would have just been very difficult, if not impossible, for them to build the kind of research base that this kind of myth propagates. In other words, that they're researching flying saucers and all of this. Because, as I take great pains to point out in all of my books, the Bell Project, which I think is the basis for these stories, just required enormous amounts of electrical power. They even built a power plant close to the facility where they were testing it. So that kind of facility in Antarctica is out. I think at best we're dealing with a very small, probably secretive U-boat resupply station and nothing more. I do think that the real story is that, and I present it and outline the case in the book, that this region in Rio Negro province of Argentina, where you have this large German compound, which required security passes and, you know, had military SS guards guarding the thing, I think that's the real location for these secret flotillas of U-boats. Now, it is true that there was such a flotilla, and let me point out what it was. the Nazi Party itself ran black boats. So the German Kriegsmarine, Grand Admiral Dönitz, had actually turned over, beginning in 1943, to Martin Bormann personally, for his own personal use, a flotilla of U-boats that were completely off the books of the German Kriegsmarine.
Okay, so you think that this flotilla did exist, but you're not saying that this trip took place.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
They were used to get the Nazis down to Latin America, not Antarctica.
All right. Now, this story, I read your book very, very rapidly. As you know, I called you the afternoon that I got it.
Yep.
And I, over the next 24 hours, read the book. And actually over probably the next 9 hours, read the book. And it was absolutely fascinating. So I'm sort of working off of memory, and it may be a little flawed. But there was a novelist, an Austrian novelist, by the name of Wilhelm Lundig. I believe he was 1909. He was born in Vienna. And he was a very staunch, strong pro-German nationalist, and wrote a series of novels that presented the whole idea of the Nazis escaping to other places. And if I'm not mistaken, that is the source of the story of the flotilla to Antarctica, is it not?
Well, that's one of them. The story that he outlines in his three novels, it's really a rather breathtaking one. He alleges there was a secret flotilla of U-boats taking all sorts of German personnel and scientific equipment. That's a key right there. From Canada to Latin America, okay? And if you read these novels, they're almost 1,000 pages long each, and, you know, in tortured, turgid German. But what Lundig does is he essentially kind of mythologizes this whole Nazi post-war enterprise. So what I did is I went through and compared point by point what he was doing and found out that, in fact, there's a basis in truth to every single point that he makes in those novels.
Yeah, I found that interesting. That you can literally strip the fiction off of the skeleton of his novel, and the main structure can be corroborated with history.
Oh yes, absolutely, no question about it. And the real key, Kevin, is that Lundig maintains they were doing post-war independent research in a very, very advanced physics projects in Latin America, and that part is absolutely 100% true.
What sort of very advanced physics projects were they engaged in?
Well, to put it in a nutshell, I know we're kind of coming up towards the top of the hour, but to give the Cliff Notes version, I believe that there was a fusion, a so-called controlled fusion project that was ostensibly under the control of Juan Perón's government, but it's very obvious that it was really under the control of these post-war Nazis in Argentina. But the man heading the project was a scientist by the name of Dr. Ronald Richter. Now get this. In Nazi Germany during the war, he worked for the Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, the AEG company, on a project codenamed Karité Anlage, doing advanced plasma research, okay? Now, this just happens to be the very same company and the very same code name as the power plant for the Bell, okay? So, in other words, the man heading this project in post-war Argentina is one of the Nazi Bell scientists. And when you read his paperclip documentation, which I reproduce in the book rather extensively, it's very clear that he's not really even thinking in terms of controlled fusion.
I hate to do it, but we are on break, and we will have to come back after break and pick up right there. All right, folks, we'll be back right after this. welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Dr. Joseph Farrell. We're talking about the Nazis and how they planned and executed the plans to continue to stay in business after World War II. The book is called Nazi International, and we'll tell you how to get the book here in a little bit. Dr. Farrell, let's go back to South America. I've heard about these Nazi enclaves in Argentina. I've heard that there are some in Paraguay. I've heard that there are some in Bolivia. What about Paraguay and Bolivia? Did you find anything on those?
Well, yeah, I didn't do any actual presentation of what I found in the book because I was really kind of interested in the physics and research story. But yes, there are certainly Nazi compounds in those countries. There was a very large one in Chile that was only in the last 15 or so years shut down. There have been rumors, and I suspect very strongly that this is true, that there are some rather large enclaves in Brazil as well. There was a Latin American journalist by the name of Jorge Camarasa, who's recently written a book released in Latin America about some of Dr. Mengele's ongoing medical experimentation in Brazil. And, of course, anytime you say that, you have to have an organization that can support you with finances, get you the laboratory equipment, the necessary personnel, and so on. So, again, the whole idea of post-war research being done and continued by these people means that you're dealing, by the nature of the case, with an extensive organization with vast financial pockets, with a security apparatus in place, and so on and so forth.
Okay, now let's go back to the fusion experiment, the physics experiments that you were talking about. You said they were working on a plasma experiments.
Right.
Okay, why is that important? What's the importance of all that?
Well, the importance is, if you go back to what I've written about the Nazi Bell project, plasmas played a key role in what they were trying to do by the way of engineering or manipulating space-time locally. And one of the interesting things that I present in this book is the actual state of the physicist that headed this project to the Americans in his paperclip file. Now, let me kind of preface that by saying when Perón announced the project to the world in 1951, the project was roundly denounced by the scientific press, by the community, by world media, and so on, as being completely and totally fraudulent, okay? But as I discovered researching this physicist's paperclip files, 4 years later, the United States Air Force is quietly and very secretly investigating him and getting in contact with him to find out what he was really up to. And the man at this time is desperate because he was basically hung out to dry by Perón's government and by the local Nazi establishment there. And he was quite literally just in need of work and money to support himself. So he kind of spilled the beans to the Americans. And what he told them was that in his view, plasmas were a way of not only measuring but tapping into the zero-point energy. And those are his words. He uses the phrase zero-point energy in those documents themselves. So in other words, he's not really doing experiments in controlled fusion at all. It's something much, much bigger. And as I've said before on your show, anytime you're dealing with that kind of energy, with the ability to manipulate it, you have the technology that will lead you to advanced field propulsion, and if you decide to weaponize it, you have a potential technology there that will make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. So it was really, really big stuff.
You're talking about technology that is on the scale of being a planet buster, aren't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the American scientists that actually reviewed Richter's work said that this guy is a mad genius working in the 1970s. In other words, you know, at the time, he was two decades ahead of the thinking of everybody else. So that gives you the idea, again, of what sort of stuff the Nazis were up to. And the interesting thing to me, Kevin, is what this really means. Because if you put it in the total context of what I write about in the book and in my other Nazi books, it's very apparent then that Martin Bormann is driving the division of the spoils pretty much equally between the Western Allies and the Soviet Union, seeing to it that they both get the ability to make rockets, A-bombs, and so on and so forth. But this type of physics, he makes very certain and sure, remains in independent Nazi hands, because what you have in Argentina basically is nothing else other than a continuation of the Bell Project. So that's a scary, scary thing to contemplate. They're kind of setting up the Cold War right during World War II, but leaving the good cards or the high cards in their own hand.
You know, when you talk about the Bell program, inevitably we have to get into UFOs. We have to get into the whole topic and the whole question of whether the things that we see and think are extraterrestrial may in fact be terrestrial and may in fact be Nazi.
Well, that is more or less the take that I have maintained in these Nazi books with respect to certain aspects of the UFO problem, specifically with regard to Roswell, with regards to Kecksburg. Now, I do not maintain that all UFO phenomena can be explained or rationalized on the basis of Nazi secret weapons research. However, I do believe that the Nazis were sufficiently advanced with this Bell project that they had got their hands on a prototypical field propulsion technology and were trying to perfect it. So, yes, I do believe that's the case.
Well, you know, we're how many years since World War II now? I mean, we're into
right.
Past 50. The war, the Germany signed when? 1945?
Germany surrendered it on May 7th and May 8th of 1945, right.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're 54 years past it?
We're more than that. We're about 60 plus years, 64 years exactly.
Yeah, 64. I dropped a decade there. All right, so we're 64 years past this. Obviously, those original Nazis that went to South America, most of them are dead by now.
Right.
One of the things that would have to continue in order for this whole operation to continue would be passing on to a next generation and to succeeding generations. The whole cultural idea and philosophy of the Nazis. And that contains some really strange stuff. a very weird mixture of some little they grab little pieces of ancient history and throw in a big helping of occult beliefs. And then give it their own special twist. How are they passing this culture forward?
Well, that is an excellent question. And for me, the real cincher or clincher in that case was the actual German reunification itself, because I spent a whole chapter in the book covering modern German reunification. And what leapt out at me, Kevin, is a story that most Americans really aren't aware of as to how reunification came about. But quite literally, on the eastern side, in the former communist zone of East Germany, this was all literally driven by neo-Nazi cells that appeared to have been very well equipped and very well financed, and most of that financing appears to have come from Chancellor Kohl's government in West Germany, okay? So putting two and two together, what I think you have evident there is that that military intelligence group that the CIA ostensibly took over after World War II, headed by German General Galen, that more or less, as everyone knows, stayed in place and then became the nucleus of the post-war West German Bundesnachrichtendienst, their version of the CIA. I like to call them the kinder, gentler Gestapo, okay? But this military intelligence network basically stayed in place and passed on its intelligence gathering capabilities to modern times. And I suspect, given the fact that you have these neo-Nazi cells driving the eastern part of the reunification, is that this group of military intelligence has a very deeply hidden Nazi ideology and agenda.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll pick up right there when we come back, and we're going to attempt to take your telephone calls on the other side. We'll be back right after this. All right, we are back, and my guest this evening, Dr. Joseph Farrell. Dr. Farrell, if you don't mind, I would like to run a quick experiment here. I want to put you back on the mixer and see if we get you on the mixer. See if you can hear me. Okay. All right. So we'll just run a little test. Can you hear me?
Yep, sure can.
Okay. Well, apparently the deal is, if you're on the air, there's a button you have to push. If you're off the air, you have to unclick it and for the phone system to work. So, anyway, fantastic. We've got things now working as they should, and callers will be able to call in. We'll hear them and you too. I don't know. It's a new system. That's all I can tell you. Pilot error, folks. Pilot error. Okay. So after the show, when I'm talking with you, I have to remember to unclick that button so I can talk with you. All right. We were talking about these fantastic experiments and the structure and how they could carry that structure forward, how they could carry that culture forward. And you were telling us about the reunification of Germany, and it was driven by neo-Nazi groups in East Germany, funded by Helmut Kohl's government.
Right.
All right. And I had to cut you off as you were getting deeper into that. So you've got the floor.
Well, yeah, it's really a very, very murky story. Most people don't realize that when the Berlin Wall came down, that very day was the anniversary of the Kristallnacht, the pogrom against the Jews in 1938. And it was also that very same day that was the anniversary of the Beer Hall Putsch attempt in Munich against the Bavarian government in 1923, that the Nazis tried to overthrow the state government of Bavaria. So, yes, the whole reunification thing has a lot of very, very murky things in it. And Kohl's government, one thing that people don't realize about Chancellor Kohl was that many of his financial backers were these so-called expellee societies, the most famous being the Silesian Expellee Society. What these were, Kevin, were groups that were controlled by that German military intelligence network that basically used them as intelligence fronts. There were whole hosts of them from Eastern Europe, the Belarusian Society and so on and so forth. And many of these, incidentally, were major financial campaign backers to President George Herbert Walker Bush's campaign in 1988. And, of course, the Democrats tried to make this a campaign issue. They didn't get anywhere with it, but it's quite true that these groups were heavily involved in funding his campaign. So you have these networks of expellee societies, and many of them were heavy contributors to Kohl's government. And Kohl, in turn, took a lot of this money and used the German intelligence budget and quietly and very secretly funded a lot of these neo-Nazi cells in the eventuality of German reunification. And, you know, it, to me, it's very peculiar that when the Soviet Union collapsed, you have on the record that the United States, the CIA, and MI6 and so on were basically not expecting it to happen. But there was one country that was ready when the Soviet Union collapsed, and that was West Germany. So you basically had kind of a shotgun wedding, really, in the German reunification, because basically West Germany stepped in with a unilateral plan for unification and kind of rammed it down the Eastern Zone's throat, which they accepted and voted on the reunification. And it's interesting to me also that shortly after this happened, Germany began in a very, very significant way that I detail in the book to flex its military and economic muscle on the European stage. It basically once again was instrumental in cracking up Czechoslovakia and basically making the Bohemian part of Czechoslovakia a kind of an economic fiefdom of Germany. And then it also hastened the crack up of Yugoslavia, because if people will recall, it was Germany unilaterally and over the opposition of London and Paris and Washington that unilaterally recognized breakaway Croatia. And then when Croatia broke away, they turned around and asked for military help against the Serbs. And, of course, the Germans, for the first time since World War II, sent troops and Luftwaffe squadrons into Croatia.
And it's very significant. I've worked in Croatia and in Bosnia. And the part of Bosnia I worked in is right on the border with Croatia. I mean, you cross a bridge, you go across the Sava River, and you're in Croatia.
Right.
And but that is, Croatia is the location of one of the nastiest SS units that ever existed.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes.
They were so bad they even became an embarrassment to the SS.
Well, yes, this is quite true, and I detail that aspect of the story. During World War II, the Nazis had set up a puppet state in Croatia, as you know, and it was headed by just this horrid regime. It was so bad that even the Nazis had to step in and say, calm it down. And I think, you know, not to ascribe altruistic reasons to the Nazis, because what the Croatians were doing, of course, was just this wholesale slaughter against the Serbs. Well, the Serbs are Eastern Orthodox. And the Nazis, of course, had Bulgaria and Romania, which were both heavily Eastern Orthodox countries, as allies. So I think the real reason for the Nazis putting the thumbscrews to this absolutely barbaric Croatian regime was simply to maintain some decent and good relations with their allies. But it's true, you know. We really watched a replay after German reunification, and it's almost scary to think about, but they took the whole playbook right out of Adolf Hitler by dismembering Czechoslovakia, setting up a puppet state in Slovakia, and then economically subduing Czechoslovakia, and then breaking up Yugoslavia by recognizing Croatia. So, yeah, the Germans moved very, very quickly after the reunification to kind of impose the way they wanted Eastern Europe to start taking shape.
All right, now, I don't intend to, with this question, to broadside you. I just thought of it as you were speaking. What about Slovenia? I've been through there on several occasions, and it seemed to me to have some German flavor to it.
Oh, yes, yeah. This whole part of that little tail end of Czechoslovakia, I believe you're talking about the region that during World War II Hungary annexed. But
no, Slovenia is one of the six republics that made up Yugoslavia.
Right, right. Okay, then I'm mistaken. But, well, to kind of put it in a nutshell, I think basically, Kevin, you have the post-war or post-unification, I should say, map of Europe being really kind of drawn up in Berlin. It's very apparent to me that Germany has pursued a very quiet foreign policy of economic domination of that region. I mean, when the Soviets pulled out, the Germans were there.
Mm-hmm.
They were there with a plan. So, yeah, we're really watching kind of Martin Bormann's dream, and I should mention that in this regard. Bormann made it very clear prior to the end of the war that his goal for post-war Europe was a European confederation which Germany would be able to dominate economically and militarily by using, and these are his words, elastic political means. So in other words, Bormann took rather a different route than the military conquest route to German domination of Europe. But, you know, it certainly looks like he fulfilled his dream.
Okay. Tell you what I want to do. I want to go ahead and open up the telephone lines for folks.
Sure.
And people around the world may have some calls that they would like to make. You may have some questions or comment that you would like to make. Well, the telephone number is 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. If you need to call me toll-free, you may do so. And it is 888-223-4599. If you're living outside of the USA and outside of Canada, you can use the toll flash message. Now, the way you do that, you go to my website, scroll down, and under the little blurb about tonight's show, you will see a link. It says flash message. And if you click that link, you will be able to send me a flash message. It won't cost you anything, and I'll read it, and then our guest will comment on it. All right, let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Ryan calling from Washington State.
Yes, Ryan.
Oh, I had a question for Dr. Farrell. Dr. Farrell, do you think that the Germans had any when they were developing the Bell? Do you think they had any assistance along the way? Is there any reason why they were so far advanced over everybody else? I guess my question is do you think that the German technology that they were using to develop anti-gravity? Do you see any evidence at all of assistance from elsewhere, or
you mean from extraterrestrials?
Correct. Do you believe
okay.
Is there any involvement, or have you seen evidence of that at all?
Well, Ryan, I get that question a lot, and I have to be very honest. I do not think that they did. I tried to pin down the stories that they did get that kind of help, but they all are rather unsubstantiated and so on and so forth. And the second point I need to make is, and I lay out this case in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell and in Secrets of the Unified Field very carefully. I don't think you need to go there to rationalize their tremendous achievements in physics and technology, because you do have a very evident paper trail in the physics papers in the 1920s and 1930s that are being published inside of Germany itself that would lead Nazi scientists to this pursuit of this technology. And secondly, you do have within the paper trail a number of papers by engineers that are looking at these unified field theories and saying these things are engineerable. They may be incomplete as physics theories, but they're nonetheless engineerable. So you've got that working in the Nazis' favor. And then finally, if you look at the physics of the Bell, and I try to do this in a new book of mine that just came out called The Philosopher's Stone, from the occult angle, there is even an occult angle that rationalizes very directly the internal configuration of the Bell device itself. So you have an entirely terrestrial basis for rationalizing their accomplishments. I don't think you need to go to ET at all.
All right. Now, we have a caller holding, and caller, if you'll just hang on a moment, I have a follow-up question. How is it that they were so far advanced of the scientists here?
Well, Kevin, that's an excellent question, and I think it goes back to the fact that the Nazis had proscribed so-called Jewish physics, in other words, relativity, okay? Now, usually we're told in the academic books that what this meant was that Nazi science, and in particular Nazi physics, was a colossal failure, and they point to a very patent and very evident track record of these failures. I'm not saying there weren't some colossal whoppers. However, what people have to realize is that this forced German physicists during that 12-year period of the Nazi regime to to think utterly outside the box, and there were some colossal successes. They really had to develop an entirely different paradigm of physics, and I take great care in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell and Secrets of the Unified Field and Nazi International and the Philosopher's Stone to outline very carefully what I think that paradigm of physics was. It was, first of all, a hyperdimensional basis, and secondly, it used physical phenomena known as torsion as the basis for achieving these things. But again, I think, Kevin, it was simply the fact that Nazi Germany created really a crucible in which the scientists had to think outside the box and do so very quickly, and they did.
So they had no choice but to excel.
Right, exactly.
Okay, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, it's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario. Hello there, doctors. Dr. Farrell, Dr. Smith.
How are you doing?
The previous caller actually stole my thunder, sort of.
Okay.
But I still want to relate to some of this. Do you think that, Dr. Joseph Farrell, do you think that what the Germans did achieve with the bell and also with, of course, the dropping of the atomic bomb and whatnot, do you think that may have actually attracted attention from elsewhere and may be, of course, the catalyst for what happened at Roswell and other UFO crashes all throughout the years, like at Kecksburg's, which wasn't even a disc or a bell-shaped, according to reports and others?
Well, that's an excellent question, and let me address it this way. If you go to Roswell, one of the things that Stanton Friedman, I think, has very astutely observed, and it was an observation that was originally made by the 50s ufologist Frank Edwards, that it appears that with the detonation of the atomic bomb, that it attracted someone's attention, as you say, okay? But what Friedman does not mention, that Edwards does mention in this respect, is the sudden appearance of UFOs approximately 1946 over the Baltic and Scandinavia. And Edwards, in his book, will mention the fact, well, it appears that they got the latitude and the longitude all wrong, okay, but I don't think so, because in my book, Reich of the Black Sun, I argue what I believe to be a very strong circumstantial case that the Germans actually detonated an atomic bomb in sometime around October 10th through the 12th in 1944, and that they did so in the Baltic, okay? Now, that makes it very interesting that if you have these UFOs showing up at both locations, the Baltic and Scandinavia, and over New Mexico, where we detonated the first American bomb, then, yeah, it would seem that what the Germans were doing may have attracted somebody's attention.
All right. Great question, Kevin. Thanks for the call. Let's go to this call, if we can bring it up. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, Kevin. This is Rusty from Michigan.
Hi, Rusty.
Hi. Dr. Farrell, I can see why they would have wanted to keep the Nazi scientists and people like them, but after they had used Hitler for the war and that, what reason would they have had for keeping him alive, you know, letting him escape?
Well, Rusty, the basic answer to it is this. First of all, it's not something that we're allowing to have happen. It's something that Martin Bormann is engineering himself, okay? And in the Nazi International, I try and kind of subtly imply the kind of leverage that he is using against the Western Allies. But as far as Bormann is concerned, the reason for keeping Hitler alive is very simple. Hitler is the very personification of the Nazi Party, and to have him survive kind of in a certain sense guarantees that post-war continuity with the pre-war and wartime institutions. So it's a very, very simple reason that he would want Hitler alive.
Okay. And one more question.
Mm-hmm.
What role do you think they may be playing in U.S. History or politics at the present moment?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Well, that is the $64,000 question, Rusty. And in my opinion, the USA literally made the deal with the devil and, in a certain sense, sold its soul by bringing over these Nazi scientists. because when we did so, we not only brought over their science, we brought over their ideology. And you have only to look around you at the stoplight cameras on, you know, on every intersection in America now. This whole police state snitch culture that we're getting into, to me, is very, very frightening. I think that their influence has been profound. And if you look at the thesis of Richard Hoagland and Mike Barra in their book Dark Mission, that kind of dovetails into what I'm saying, they argue the case that in the end, by the end of the Apollo missions, it was precisely the Nazis within NASA that had the most significant influence over mission planning and agendas, to the extent that some Apollo and Surveyor missions were landed on some of these significant Nazi anniversaries, dates of significant Nazi anniversaries. And there's one Apollo event that is so crucial in that regard, and that's the first moon landing itself, Apollo 11. It landed on July 20th, 1969, which was the 25th anniversary of the failed bomb plot against Adolf Hitler in 1944. So I think their influence has been very, very significant and very pervasive. It's just something that most Americans are unaware of, unfortunately.
Rusty, that was such a good question. I'm going to do something that I haven't done before. I'm going to send you this Our Star Wars reel just for asking such a good question. So here's what you need to do. You need to send me an email with your mailing address, and I'll drop this in the mail in the morning.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. Great question.
Yep.
All right, folks. We would love to hear your question, what's on your mind. You know, it's just amazing to me that we all seem to be so fascinated with the Nazis.
Yeah.
I am. It's just a fascinating, fascinating subject. Not because I think they were great people or they did good things, but I guess I'm attracted to the information and fascinated by the information because being, I think, what most people would term evil, being so evil, look at, in the midst of all that, the tremendous advances they did make. Yeah. And you just kind of wonder how, you know, I mean, how could such bad guys come up with such fantastic advances? But they did. And then now, you know, I'm fascinated because I've read your book. And, you know, by the way, folks, let me tell you about this book. It is very well documented, footnoted, all the way through here. And so a lot of times you hear me on this show say, how do you know that? Well, when you read this book, on the bottom of each page almost every page, there are footnotes where he shows you where he got that information. All right, we'll have to be very quick with this, but caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, Kevin, it's Terry from Ohio. I got just a couple quick things.
Okay, Terry, we have a break that will take over in just a moment. If the break takes over, you just hang on and we'll get you first up after the break, okay?
Okay.
All right.
I just would say that I wondered if the Nazis lost because they had their feet in so many different areas that they imploded because of all their different things that they were trying to do. And two, do you believe that they are alive and well in the United States today as they were back then? And I'll take it off the air.
All right. We've got a minute till break. Dr. Farrell?
Well, let me take the second part of the question first. Are they alive and well in the USA and elsewhere? And in my opinion, yes. You have only to look at some of these very right-wing militia groups and so on and so forth, many of whom have very, very subtly disguised and hidden ties to this post-war Nazi organization. So the answer to that is yes. The other part of your question as to whether they lost the war because they had their hands in too many pies and were trying to do too much, that's best a question I'd better handle after the break because it's a rather complex answer, I'm afraid.
Okay, fair enough. And because you would only have less than 10 seconds anyway. All right, we'll be back, folks, right after this. I told you this was going to be good. I never lie to you. We'll be back. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Dr. Joseph Farrell. Dr. Farrell, you left a question hanging for the for that last caller, and the floor is yours, sir, if you'd like to answer it.
Well, he asked if the Nazis had lost the war because they had their fingers in too many of these research pies, I think was what he was getting at. And the simple answer is no, because we have to remember one very significant thing, that most of these secret research projects were being accomplished by the massive slave labor pool that the Nazis had available in the concentration camps, okay? The reasons the Nazis lost the war, they're many and varied and complex, but I always go to some crucial decisions that Hitler made at certain points during the war, military decisions that he took, that he basically had the Allies or the Soviets pinned and then didn't follow up on his victory, the first being, of course, the decision at Dunkirk not to eliminate and simply annihilate the captured British army there while it was stuck on the beaches. And then, secondly, the decision that he took in August of 1941 after the German invasion of the Soviet Union. He, by the end of the second month of that campaign, had literally decimated about 60% of the Red Army, and his tank armies stood about 250 miles from Moscow with almost nothing opposing them. And, of course, you take Moscow, and you've pretty well game over, you know. That's the communications and industrial hub of European Russia. But what he did at that juncture was he turned one of these panzer armies about 650 miles south to encircle a bunch of Russian forces around Kiev, and by the time that that army made it back to its starting position in front of Moscow, it was October, and of course the rest is history. So I think you have to look to some of Hitler's military decisions that were taken at these crucial turning points of the war in which he made the wrong decision, quite literally, in order to rationalize the Nazi defeat.
Outstanding. Russia has been the bane of many an invader.
Yes, that it has. But, you know, the comparison, Kevin, is often made between Hitler's invasion and Napoleon's, and there really is no comparison because, for one thing, most of Russia's industrial plant at that time lies in European Russia. And secondly, Napoleon is invading on an invasion front about 30 miles wide from Königsberg, East Prussia, to Moscow. When Hitler's invading, you know, this is no 30-mile-wide affair. He's invading on a front that literally stretches all the way from the Arctic Circle to the Black Sea. So, in other words, we're dealing with a much larger operation to begin with. And like I say, you know, by the end of the second month of Operation Barbarossa, they had quite literally liquidated about 60% of the operational strength of the Red Army. And there was literally nothing opposing him to march right on into Moscow. But, you know, and there's a famous conference that took place between Hitler and his generals, including the general that led this assault down towards Kiev that wanted to continue to Moscow. This general quite literally lost his temper and went apoplectic. But, you know, orders were orders, and you know, that was the war. And in fact, this general even wrote, as I recall, if I recall correctly, in his diaries that, you know, that's it, the war is lost. You know, he's made the wrong decision. So, yeah, it's a very, very different affair with the German invasion of Russia.
All right, let's go back to the telephone line. By the way, the telephone number, folks, is 602-539-9580 or 888-223-4599. That's the toll-free number. And, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Mark from Ohio.
Yes, Mark.
I have three questions for Dr. Farrell, and I'll take the answers off the air. The first is, Lieutenant Colonel Wendell Stevens has talked about an anti-gravity craft he calls the Hanabu in many of his videos. And in one particular video, he says the Hanabu shot down 200 of our bombers in I believe it was the Battle of Schweinfurt. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you had ever heard of that.
Okay, there's two parts to my answer. First of all, I unfortunately do not place much stock in the stories of Hanabu and real flying saucers. The reason being, Mark, is that these stories come out of a narrow circle of neo-Nazis operating after the war. And other than some, I believe, very carefully contrived disinformation in the form of fake documents, there's really nothing to support their existence if you really, really dig into the story. Now, I'm not saying the Germans were not researching saucer-type craft. They were. But they had not got to that pitch of development. If you want to find out why, then again, you'd have to go to my books about the Nazi Bell device, because I outlined the case of what they actually did very, very carefully and the physics it was based on. But the second part of your question about Schweinfurt, there is a deal of documentary evidence in British and American archives that the Germans used something at Schweinfurt that was knocking bombers out of the air, and that it was very unconventional. My problem is ascribing that to this Hanabu story. I haven't been able to pin down exactly what they were using there. Some people think it was this so-called Feuerball device or Kugelblitz device and so on and so forth. I haven't been able to pin that down.
Very interesting. Do you think the Germans and the Nazis had anti-gravity at the time of the Apollo missions? And if so, what do you believe was the real purpose of Apollo?
Oh, boy, that's a lollapalooza of a question. And an excellent one. I do believe that the Bell was brought to a sufficient pitch of development prior to the end of the war that it did achieve a field propulsion effect, in other words, an anti-gravity effect. The problem the Germans had at that juncture was they were not able to put anyone inside the device to be able to fly it around. Its field effects were very, very severe on organic living things. So they were actually studying how to limit that. Now, in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, I have a picture of one of the Bell project scientists standing next to Dr. Wernher von Braun at NASA, and that man's name is Dr. Kurt Davis. He was a senior flight administrator for the Apollo program at Cape Canaveral. Okay, and incidentally, I put documentation in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell that he was an ardent Nazi. Okay, but this man was the actual designer of the power plant for the Bell, that very man. Now, his presence in Apollo suggests to me, Mark, that there is an alternative technology in play in the Apollo missions, and here's why I think that. Shortly after Apollo 11 landed on the moon, Dr. von Braun gave a short interview to Time magazine a few weeks after the event, in which he disclosed the fact that the neutral point of gravity between the Earth and the Moon was some 43,500-some-odd miles from the surface of the Moon. Now, that is almost twice the distance that it should be if the Moon were only one-sixth of the gravity of the Earth, okay? So if you go to those films or TV footages of the lunar excursion modules taking off from the Moon, what you'll see there is the device actually seems to simply pop up and accelerate away at a more or less uniform rate of speed. Now, a rocket, if you watch a rocket accelerate, it accelerates geometrically per unit of time, okay? So, to me, most people think that, well, that means that the Apollo things were all hoaxed, you know, because we don't see enough of a rocket plume and it doesn't have the signature of a rocket and so on and so forth, ergo it's all a big hoax. But to me, it says something different. It says we really went there, but it may have been an alternative technology that got us through those Van Allen radiation belts, and more importantly, got us off the moon once we were on it. And the presence of Dr. Kurt Davis in the Apollo program at that senior level of NASA is, to me, very suggestive of that fact.
All right. I've got some flash messages that have come in from around the world. This one from Jeff over in Australia. It says, this Nazi thing is very interesting. I was listening to the Mysteries of the Mind show hosted by Alex Merklinger a few years ago when he had a guest talking about whether Hitler had made it out of Germany at the end of the war. Towards the end of the show, a woman phoned in and said that she was the granddaughter of Adolf Hitler, and she also said, quote, "Grandpa died in 1992, end quote. The mind boggles, Kevin. That's from Jeff in Hobart, Tasmania.
Well, let me comment on that a bit, Kevin. That's very interesting. Hitler was born in 1888, April 20th, 1888. So if he died in 1992, that would have made him 104 years old. So, you know, he lived to be a very old age. I'm rather suspicious of claims like that because it's suspected very strongly that Hitler suffered from some form of Parkinson's disease towards the end of his life. He was displaying certain symptoms of it. But I don't doubt that Hitler did make it out of Europe and probably survived for a number of years afterward in Argentina or other enclaves in Latin America. Now, the point about children is very interesting because there's a certain amount of evidence that sometime around 1942, Hitler and Eva Braun actually did have a child and that it was kept very, very secret. So that part of the story may in fact have a certain ring of truth to it.
All right, here is one from the United Kingdom, from Nigel. Do you think there's a connection between the Bell and the Philadelphia experiment, or was it all a hoax?
Nigel, that's excellent. Actually, I have a book called Secrets of the Unified Field, and the subtitle of that book is The Philadelphia Experiment, the Nazi Bell, and the Discarded Theory. So my answer is yes, I do think there's a connection between the physics of the Bell and the physics of the Philadelphia Experiment. No, I don't think the Philadelphia Experiment was a hoax at all. I think they actually did this thing. The primary difference between the Philadelphia Experiment and the Nazi Bell is that I do not think the American scientists were expecting quite the results that they got. In other words, they hadn't rationalized the physics out, in my opinion, to nearly the depth that the Germans did. But yes, I think there's a definite connection.
Okay. I have had momentarily, temporarily, close the phone down so we could get to those flash messages. But the telephone line is open again, folks, and the telephone number is 602-539-9580 or toll-free 888-223-4599. I find it very, very interesting, Dr. Farrell, that a number of UFO sighting reports have claimed that they saw what looked like either a swastika or a German cross emblazoned on the UFO. There are some contact reports where people say that they actually had contact with the occupants of the thing. Mm-hmm. And they spoke, they looked Nordic, they said, and spoke with a German accent.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are such reports, and in fact, one of the most famous, of course, is the Betty and Barney Hill case, because under hypnosis, Barney Hill was asked what the occupants looked like, and he responds to his doctor that, well, they look like Nazis, you know, and I've always thought that very suspicious, but I put a story of a contactee, early 1950s contactee experience down here in Kearney, Nebraska.
Hate to do it, we have to take a break. It's taking over, and our mics will go dead. We'll get to that right after this. Don't go away, folks. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest, Dr. Joseph Farrell. Dr. Farrell, again, we had to cut you off in the right in the middle of a sentence. The floor is yours, sir.
Well, I was mentioning these cases of German-speaking or Nordic type of contactees, and there's a very famous case from 1952 down here in Kearney, Nebraska, about 8 hours' drive from where I live. And the fellow's name was Reinhold Schmidt. He was a German-speaking American. And he was taken aboard a craft, so he says, in 1952, in which all the occupants spoke High German, okay? And it's very clear if you read his account, and I reproduce it in the book, that he himself is taking great pains not to ascribe this as an extraterrestrial craft, but as something purely terrestrial, although a rather advanced type of system. Interestingly enough, after he began to talk about his experience a couple days after it had happened, the United States Air Force shows up, and they literally go out of their way to try and paint this guy as some sort of nut, even to the point of having him committed to a mental institution at one juncture. So, yeah, you have these stories from all over, and to me they're a little indicator that this Nazi continuation of research after the war is probably, in fact, true.
Okay, folks, we have time for one more telephone call. 602-539-9580 or toll-free 888-223-4599. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller.
Hello?
You're live on the air. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Oh, this is Victoria and calling from Washington State. And I'm enjoying your program, and I was wondering... about a year ago, I'm not sure which station or news it was on, the network or cable news, they announced that that George Bush had, George W. Bush had bought a ranch in South America, and I was trying to figure out if it was near Paraguay or if it was near somewhere near where you say this...
It was in Paraguay.
Yes, Paraguay.
I was just wondering if it was in close proximity to where this supposed Nazi establishment that you had talked about earlier is located in.
Okay.
No, that particular compound that I mentioned earlier in the show is actually about 900 and some miles southwest of Buenos Aires, so it wouldn't be near that. However, Paraguay itself, you know, was well known as a Nazi haven, so it doesn't surprise me, you know, that they might want to be near old family friends, so to speak.
Yeah, kissing cousins, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Victoria, is this your first time to call the show?
Yes.
Well, you can't go till we give you some applause here. There you go. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. And call again soon sometime. All right. Outstanding. We're getting calls from all over.
Over.
and flash messages from around the world. That's good. Absolutely wonderful. All right. Let's see how much time we've got. Yeah, we got a few minutes left here. We have time for, if you call right now, folks, I've got time to get one more call in here. But I don't want time to slip away, folks. Without Dr. Farrell telling us where you can get his books. Dr. Farrell?
Well, most of my books are at Amazon or available from Adventures Unlimited Press, and that number is toll-free during normal business hours. It's 1-800-718-4514. I do have one new book out called The Philosopher's Stone. That's available from a different publisher by the name of Farrell House, F-E-R-A-L. And I don't have the number there, but that book is available at Amazon.com as well.
Outstanding. Well, you know, I explained to people at the beginning of the show, I have to apologize that it took me so long to get this book into my hands and read it and call you to get you to come on the show and talk about it. It got delivered to a different address. It didn't get delivered to me. And the person finally got in touch with me and said, you know, you got a package over here. And so I went and picked up the package, and the book was in it. So I don't know how long it had been there, for weeks, I guess, maybe months. But I have to tell you, I read books all the time. Lots of books come through here. This is one of the best written, best documented books, giving an alternative view of modern history than I have ever read. It, folks, this takes your breath away. You've got to get this. You've got to read it. And again, let me hold it up for those who are watching our TV channel. There we go. It is called Nazi International, and you couldn't see that very well. Let me just put a graphic up that has the cover of the book on it. But you got to go get this. This book, the price it's printed on it is $19.95, and we've got let's see how many pages we've got in here. 413 pages. 413 pages, only $19.95, and you got to go get it. It will take your breath away. It will make you see things in a whole new light, and at least make you raise one eyebrow and say, could it be? According to your book, they have been successful, the Nazis have been successful, at insinuating themselves or infiltrating themselves into virtually every corner of the power structures of the globe.
Yes, yes. One of the things we didn't talk about tonight that is worth mentioning briefly, Kevin, is that they were very successful in networking, so to speak, with the radical Muslim factions in Egypt and the Middle East and sponsoring terrorism. So, yeah, there's a very contemporary angle to all of this, and they were very successful at it.
Well, what can be done?
Well, in my opinion, I think we have to, first of all, inform ourselves and go back and scrutinize the history of World War II very carefully and begin to ask some very, very pointed questions of the official histories. And for another thing, we need to be extremely skeptical. We need to go back to that Jeffersonian ideal of being extremely skeptical and cynical about our government leaders and you know, just holding their feet to the fire almost constantly, because they're just getting away with way, way too much.
I'm not going to ask you to name names. That might not be good for your health, but in your opinion, do we have some of these guys in our government?
Yeah. One of the things, again, we didn't talk about is what I think the historical context of this Nazi International actually may mean for the current financial meltdown. So.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
There's an angle to this that is really very, very scary. But again, you know, anytime you're playing ball with Martin Bormann and getting lots of money from him, so to speak, to launder, it's going to come with a very high price tag. So I think we may be witnessing some of the ramifications of deals that were made right after the war.
Well, I've always heard if you dance with the devil, there's hell to pay.
That's right. That's right.
And these guys, if there's anything you can say about them, you've got to say that these were some of the most crafty, cunning, smart, absolutely sharp individuals that have lived within the last two centuries. That doesn't mean that I'm praising them, but I'll give credit where credit is due. And you've got to say these guys in an evil way, but still these guys were absolutely sharp.
Yes, absolutely. I couldn't agree more, Kevin. It's a scary, scary story when you get right down to it and finish contemplating all the different connections and dots and ramifications of it. It is very, very scary.
Dr. Farrell, I want to thank you for being with us. We've reached the end of the show. If you will, just stay on the line with me a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, another great week at the Kevin Smith Show. And we got another one next week. You know that happens. Like oxygen, it's just there. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.